Hey, g'day, g'day. Welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction. This would be episode the 45th. My name's Dick Newman. We're keen to get on crusade. We're so keen, we're going to do two crusades. Can't go worse than the last few, can it? Maybe it can. Let's get on with it. A little bit of Vide Cor Meum to get us on our way. In our language, See My Heart by the great Irish composer Patrick Cassidy. They used it in a few films, including Kingdom of Heaven. It's recap time, but is there any point recapping the Fourth Crusade, I ask you? The main force of these guys are still in Constantinople, taking over the Byzantine Empire and forcing people to have their bread without yeast. Any guys who did make it to the Middle East were done over by the Muslims. We also covered that alleged children's crusade and found out it may have all been imaginary, or more likely based on something that happened with some key hearing voices, but it made no difference to our history. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, Saladin's younger brother, Al-Adil, had managed to take over things and was up for a peace-loving-lentils type policy. He had invited Italian merchants into Egypt and done a deal with the Venetians. Al-Adil is up for the easy life with some nice making money and no war unless we can't avoid it. Good on you, Al-Adil. It would seem that our established Christians in the Middle East shared Al-Adil's peace, love and lentils ideals, and we were cool with this no-fighting stuff. But the problem remains that we get these new and keen guys turning up from Europe with their lust for a holy war, kill all the Muslims, all that bullshit. This is about to happen again. We need to start by looking at our King of Jerusalem. By now this title is a bit dicey. Christians haven't held Jerusalem for a long time, so Muslims are calling the top dog for the Christians the King of Antioch, and I'm with the Muslims on this. We'd left it with Isabella and her fourth man, Amalric. Isabella had died in 1205, and we know she comes from a long line of women who make their babies the female kind. So Isabella had five daughters, and the eldest was Maria, daughter of Isabella, and that Conrad who had been assassinated by the Hashashins when Maria was still a bun in Isabella's oven. We now have a 13-year-old Queen of Jerusalem. Regent will be Orlando Bloom's little boy, John of Ibelin. John, like his dad Balian, will continue the peace, love and lentils policy with Al-Adil. Our dear little Maria will grow up, so she gets to be 17 and the regency is over. Obviously, our not terribly bright men will decide that she needs a man in her life to provide that guidance that the inferior gender needs. Yeah, they're just jerks then, jerks now, aren't they? Men, they're just fucking idiots. Our guys asked the advice of Phil Augustus, who will recommend a very broke guy, John of Brienne. Unfortunately, I didn't research anything to see whether this guy was related to the marvellous Brienne of Tar. What's her name? The Beauty. But maybe they're related, maybe not. Or am I crossing over the streams with Game of Thrones again? He's so broke that Phil and the Pope will stump up cash so he doesn't look like a total loser. Next year, 40-year-old John will score 18-year-old Maria and a silly hat, but we should remember that it's Maria who has the bloodline. John will have an each-way bet. He will renew the truce with Al-Adil for 5 years. Love you guys. Peace, man. At the same time, he'll start a letter-writing campaign to the Pope. Send hard men crusaders so we can kill these fuckers. Maria will pop out a baby. If you guessed it's a girl, then well done. But poor Maria will die shortly after leaving John as kind of a king regent. So he'll act as king in every way, but really he is the regent, and when baby Isabella comes of age, he will be out no doubt with a lot of pushing and shoving. Let's just have him for king as now. The papal bull has been issued, promises made on the direct to heaven deal, and it's a matter of geeing up people to go. We've had a ton of Frenchy types all going to the Crusades, but this time they'll be sitting it out. Sort of. We may recall they've got their own crusade going on against, well, their own countrymen, the Cathars, with their weird magical dualist ideas. They need a good killing, so Frenchy types were too busy doing this to go over to the Middle East. One of the Pope's big hopes in this was Georgia, which is a state just north of Turkey. Georgia was capable of getting as many as 45,000 troops for the Fifth Crusade, and that would have been pretty darn effective. But we're in the time of one Genghis Khan, who was creating a gigantic empire. If you're not familiar with this guy, like, he is huge in history. Genghis Khan the Mongol, who started with basically nothing and ended up with just an enormous empire. If we have a look at the percentage of population that this guy killed, Genghis Khan is top of the pops. Killed way more people than Stalin, Hitler, anybody. Sometime after the creation of his empire, the planet started to cool. Reason was, Genghis Khan had killed so many people that forests were growing back. He's also said to be the ancestor to a bloody huge portion of the world's population right now. Banged so often that he just turned out hundreds and thousands of bloody kiddies. And he's very nasty and obviously very, very effective in battle. But eventually he'll cheese off one of his wives, wife's number 723 or something, and she will just kill him. The Khan's good buddy and best general Sabbatai was in the area, and he decided it would be a good idea to invade Georgia. So we're going to have a battle between 20,000 Mongols, we think, and about 60,000 Georgians. Mongols really know their business, so thousands of Georgians are slaughtered with minimal Mongol losses. King of Georgia gets out of there, back to his stronghold, and sits tight waiting for the full Mongol invasion. He's shitting bricks. But for Sabbatai, it was just a nice outing, and he's off to build up other people. Point is, King George of Georgia is hiding out and shitting razor blades. No way is he coming on crusade, and it seems he hasn't got time to write to anyone to let them know that he'll be a no-show. We're off to a typical great start, aren't we? Even though Georgian George won't be turning up, we've still got Hungary and the Holy Roman German sausages up for it. Our top sausage is now Fred II, who took over from Otto. Otto got booted out after that battle where he was on Team Wicked King John and got done by Phil Augustus. We may like to give Fred II a big shout out for being the first European to outlaw trial by ordeal. That was that stupid stuff where you tell people to hold red-hot coals or something, and if you aren't burnt, then you're innocent. Fred thought this was all mumbo-jumbo magical bullshit. Well done, Fred. Fred will promise to go himself on a number of occasions, but keep putting it off. Eventually he'll send his good mate, Louis, Duke of Bavaria. Oh, now I feel like a nice Topfenstrudel. Let's get back to the Holy Land, where Aladil thinks he's got a nice truce going on with John of Brienne. It would obviously be better if it was Brienne of Tarth, but she's busy looking after Stark girls. Sansa and Arya really don't need looking after, but Brienne doesn't seem to notice that. Let's get back on track. September 12, 17, and our Muslims notice new Christians with sharp pointy stuff are turning up at Acre. Then more come. Then more come. Oh, fuck it, they say. Here we go again. In fact, Aladil is now 73 and unwell. He's done very well putting up with Muslim churchy types getting up him for not continuing the jihad, and he's pretty disappointed with the Christians. First he had heard about it was some demented sausage types were belting up villages round Galilee, and he didn't think much about it, just stupid Christian types being, well, stupid Christians. He still thought he truly had a peace going on. The other thing he didn't know was that, like the Fourth Crusaders, this mob were looking to take Egypt in the first instance. Aladil will get a report that thousands of Crusaders had now gathered at Damietta, a port town east of Alexandria. Damietta is on the corner of the Mediterranean Sea and the Nile River. Aladil will send his son Al-Kamil off with some hard guys, but when he gets there he says, fuck this, way too many guys wandering around covered in metal. But he won't run away, he'll retreat to the south and hang around. Damietta is well fortified, and there is this bloody big chain from their citadel to an island in the Nile that kind of protects them from attack by water. Crusaders will attack for about 3 months, with Al-Kamil making raids on them, doing okay in the killing department. During the 3 months, the Crusaders had managed to break the chain. They then get the bright idea of making two ships into a platform for a siege tower, and it's all over for the citadel at Damietta. Not the entire town, but they've got the citadel. Aladil will get the news. He'll have a heart attack and die. Really bad timing for a succession crisis for Team Muslim. Al-Kamil was supposed to get Egypt after his dad's death, but of course there'll be guys in Cairo who think, well, my boy should get this. Al-Kamil will hotfoot it down to Cairo, and the Christians can complete their conquest of Damietta without much opposition. Al-Kamil will crap his pants. It's an invasion. Al-Kamil seems to be pretty darn self-interested. He's interested in saving Egypt only, so he will offer the Crusaders, you won't believe it, he will offer them Jerusalem. Yep, the Holy of Holies, the toy we all want, has just been offered to the Christians. Will this be all over for the Fifth Crusade? Will we just go back to Europe saying, yeah, we did it, easy peasy. Don't know what the fuss has been about, really. We're so way better than Dick I Am the One. But no, no way, no, we're not taking it. Fuck it, says Al-Kamil. What about if I toss in all of Palestine west of the Jordan River? That would give the whole coastline back to the Christians, including Jerusalem. This has got to be an absolute magnificent win for the Fifth Crusade. John of Brienne has just orgasmed over this offer. All the resident Christians are tossing huge parties. Headlines in all the Murdoch press screaming out, we won the war, this is brilliant. But after the big cock-up of the Fourth Crusade, who still haven't even turned up, the Pope wanted to make sure his voice would be loud and clear and on the spot. So he handpicked his very best offsider and total fanatic, Spanish Cardinal Pelagius. Pelagius is one of those never-negotiate-with-Muslim types. What a cockhead. And besides, he wants a holy war. Of course we'll win because we've got baby Jesus on the team. This totally fucking amazing offer will be turned down. Bill I, Count of Holland, says, this is just fucking stupid, and he's off home. Now, John of Brienne had been part of this. He said that he's now the ruler of Damietta, but Palladius says, no, it's a papal state, so John's off home to Antioch to sulk. Why, oh why, do we constantly let boring old dickhead white men rule us? But we will have a big gun turning up for Team Christian. May I present to you St. Francis of Assisi, patron saint of puppies and kittens. He'll turn up to convert the Muslims, fail, and go home again. Yeah, well, he did turn up. Pelagius now wants to take Egypt, but he'll hang around in Damietta. He is waiting for reinforcements, either Fred the German Sausage, who won't be coming, or perhaps those Georgians, most of whom been killed by the Mongols. Sit tight, Pelagius, you total dick. Al-Kamil will send messages all across the Middle East. Help wanted. Plus, he'll sort out his fleet in Alexandria and send them to do over the Crusader fleet, which they do. With this victory, Al-Kamil will send another offer for that peace treaty. And this time, he's going to toss in the true cross. Not that he's got it. No way, says Cardinal Pelagius to the Christians. If he wants peace, that just shows he's weak. Summer 1221, and just to keep us on track, 14-year-old Henry III is king. Bill Marshall has been dead for 2 years. Even Pelagius is tired of waiting for reinforcements, so it's off to Cairo for our Crusaders. Al-Kamil has gotten some support from a couple of brothers. One's come to Cairo to support, while the other is headed north to cut the Crusaders off from retreating to Damietta. Our new Christian guys can now find out about those Muslim tactics. Ride in, fire off some arrows, and nick off. A couple of thousand Germans will just turn around and head back to Damietta. Now it's time for a lesson on how the Nile River works. Summer in Egypt, and the Nile rises and starts to flood the land. Now this isn't particularly deep water, but it spreads, and so we've got men in metal trying to march through mud. That doesn't work too well. Crusaders work out that going on to Cairo ain't going to work, so how about we turn around and go back to Damietta? That's when the Egyptian forces break down a couple of dikes and the Christians find themselves totally surrounded by mud and water. They are in deep shit. Well, deep mud, really. But the point is, they're stuffed. And the Muslims can just keep raiding in, killing a few guys here and a few guys there. Nice time for Pelagius to send a message to Alcamil accepting the peace offer. Sorry, says Alcamil, offer has expired. I'd love to give you that one, just a bit too late, sorry. Here's a new one. We want an 8-year peace and you will then be allowed to fuck off out the Middle East without us killing you. And you can forget about Jerusalem and all that other stuff, but I will toss in a small bit of the true cross. How about that? And that, my dear sweet listener, is that. The Fifth Crusade is done and dusted, and it's another dud. The lads are all off home with nothing to show and plenty of casualties. Oh, fuck, these guys are idiots, are they not?
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find it.
Pelagius could have been the rock star of the Christian world. He could have had it all, but he wanted to kill Muslims as well. What a dickhead. What's the lesson for us? Listening to religious fanatics is a bad idea. But of course, back in Europe, they'll see it as it's not Pelagius' fault at all. No. It's Fred the German sausage failing to turn up. It's all his fault. He is the bad guy. If Fred had turned up, then we would have won absolutely everything. Fred the German sausage emperor had promised to go on that crusade. He didn't personally go because there was a normal succession stuff going on and he needed to make sure his position was secure in Germany before leaving the place. We need to examine this guy. His first top job was actually King of Sicily, which he had inherited as a boy. Then he inherited the Holy Roman Emperor, so he got Germany and northern Italy. That now puts the papal state of Rome in between Fred's lands in Italy and Sicily, or between a rock and a hard place. Just to complicate things, we may recall that a number of Italian city-states now exist that were part of the empire. So Fred and future Holy Roman Emperors will be kept very busy with those things. It's all very annoying. Fred had made a political marriage with Constance of Aragon, who died a couple of years later. Now the Pope really, really wants Fred to go on crusade. Sure, says Fred. All good in Germany, so I'm good to go. But I only want to go as King of Jerusalem. Says the Pope. Let's see. John of Brienne and Maria had had that little girl, Isabella. She's 11 now, so that seems like a good age for her to get married to a nice 27-year-old emperor. So let's get the party started. Fred and Isabella will be married by proxy. That's where other people pretend to be you and say the holy magical vows on your behalf. Fred's now married to Isabella. Fred will send ships to Isabella and her dad John, and they can come to Italy for another ceremony. Fred can then leap into action and get John of Brienne dispossessed. Don't fret too much for John. He'll end up as Emperor of Latin Constantinople. Isabella, however, will be kept in what's known as seclusion, so a prisoner in a fancy cell with servants. Fred will start banging Isabella, and she'll have her first kiddie when she's just 14. Terrible. A girl won't survive the year. She'll have another one at 16 and then die. Who the fuck would want to be a medieval noble girl? Her eldest boy, good on her, she's made a boy, Conrad, is now King of Jerusalem at 2 years old with Fred as regent. Conrad will also eventually inherit Sicily and the Holy Roman Empire. Alcamil is stunned by the news of the marriage. Fred's got a big reputation, so he'll send a deputation to Sicily to get the lowdown on this guy. Deputation reports that Fred had spent his carefree boyhood days in Sicily, where there was a large Muslim population. Fred can speak Arabic, thinks Muslims are pretty darn civilised, whereas Europeans are a bunch of barbarians. Yeah, I'll go along with that. Not a big fan of the Pope. Fred has Muslims as his guards and is okay with the whole Muslim observance of their religion. Al-Kamil and Fred will become pen pals, sending lots of emails to each other. They will discuss Greek philosophers and science and so on. Gifts will be sent. We're becoming best buddies, and Al-Kamil is now excited about Fred turning up to be the king. One thing Al-Kamil may have neglected to mention is that he's fallen out with his brother, who happens to be the one running Jerusalem. Perhaps Al-Kamil would prefer his BFF, Fred, to be running Jerusalem rather than an unfriendly and ambitious brother. Plus, we're all getting a bit worried about that ever-expanding Mongol Empire, so having a big, powerful Fred in between them and Egypt might be nice. So while he hasn't given Fred his motive, he's let Fred know that he thinks Fred should have all the seafront territory and he should have Jerusalem. Okay, says the Pope. Fred, your majesty, king of Jerusalem, off you go to the Holy Land, slutty, fame and glory and all that. 1227, 2 years after his marriage to Isabella, Fred finally sets out for the Holy Lands. But 3 days out to sea and our crusaders all get a runny nose and have to go home. Pope gets the message that Fred is on sick leave, calls bullshit on that, and Fred is excommunicated. June 1228, and Fred is over his nasty head cold, so he's off again. Hang on, says the Pope, I excommunicated you for not going on crusade, so you can't go on crusade. What? Fred is excommunicated again, this time for actually going on crusade. I'm not sure how that works, but I think it's one of those rules like a double negative where one cancels the other out. But I always told you theology is not my strong suit and that with the magical stuff you can just make it up as you go along. Fred will have a stopover at the duty-free shops in Cyprus. At this stage, John of Ibelin is the constable of Cyprus. Fred and John will have a stoush because Fred thinks Cyprus is his, or Isabella's, which means his. Fred will demand John hands over his lands in Beirut. John points out that Cyprus is nothing to do with the Holy Lands, and you can't demand lands over there for stoushes that happen in Cyprus. Fred has just got off to a great start. He's got the powerful Ibelin family offside. Let's get Fred to Acre in September 1228, but things have changed. Al-Kamil's brother had died suddenly, leaving Jerusalem to his young and inexperienced son. Al-Kamil is now thinking Al-Kamil should have Jerusalem, and it would be nice if Fred pissed off home again. Fred, who had received those messages from Al-Kamil pretty much offering him Jerusalem, had only brought a small force of 3,000 guys. Who needs an army if the place is being, well, just offered up? Let's make it worse for Fred. Churchy types are against him because he's excommunicated, and the local noble types aren't happy with him because he treated their mate John of Ibelin badly. They think he's another European who wants to impose European shit on them, sort of like another Wicked King John type. Al-Kamil doesn't want to renege on the deal, but he's up for some stalling. Let's steam open Fred's carrier pigeon to see what he replies to Al-Kamil. Kidding, Christians are still a couple of hundred years away from using the dicky bird. Let's steam open a standard old letter instead. Fred to Al-Kamil. I am your friend. It was you who urged me to make this trip. The Pope and all the kings of the West now know of my mission. If I return empty-handed, I will lose much prestige. For pity's sake, give me Jerusalem, that I might hold my head high. Yeah, no, says Al-Kamil. If I give you Jerusalem, my churchy types will toss me out in the street. Sorry, bro, no can do. Fred to Al-Kamil. Mate, you're a smarty pants. Can you exercise your brain to come up with a way out of this mess? Al-Kamil to Fred. Hey, man, look, I can't just give up Jerusalem without any sort of a fight. But if there was some sort of dust-up, not a huge dust-up, but some sort of dust-up, then perhaps maybe I might just have to give you something to get a truce going, if you know what I mean. Fred to Al-Kamil. Message received and understood, mate. Love your work. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Fred will now head over to Jaffa with a ton of pomp and ceremony. Some guys will sign on and Fred can announce loudly that he's off on a very, very holy war. Al-Kamil will spread the word around the Muslims that this is going to be the mother of all wars. And while we've got every confidence in our brave men and women, oh, hang on, no girls allowed. While we have every confidence in our brave men to defend us, let's be very clear that we face a very large and powerful force. Brave Fred will march his men through the desert facing zero attacks from the Muslims. All we need to do is look big and powerful, which is a bit tricky because he doesn't have that many guys. Al-Kamil can tell the population that he has saved the day from what would have been total slaughter, rape and pillage of Muslims. He did this by entering into serious and very hard-fought negotiations with Fred, and the good news is that he totally did Fred over in those negotiations. We have a peace treaty and we get to keep a little bit of Jerusalem. Ain't that terrific? Sure, Fred gets a stronghold or two around the place and we give up some beachfront land to him. Well, yeah, a lot of beachfront land if you insist, but we have peace in our times. It's a glorious victory for we Muslims. Yeah, great, isn't it? Fred can now tour Jerusalem. Along the way, he'll see a priest. This is a Christian priest about to enter a mosque. No fucking way, says Fred. If any of you Christian churchy types try to enter a mosque without my permission, then you'll find your eyeballs stuffed up your ass. On his first night in town, Muslim types won't do the evening call to prayer out of respect for the new boss. Fred will complain in the morning, saying that that's the reason he'd stayed there the night. He likes hearing the evening call to prayer, reminds him of his boyhood in Sicily. Fred is definitely looking like a Muslim lover. He'll see some lattice work on a mosque one day and ask what it's for. It's to keep the pigeons out, they say. Sure, says Fred, but then why did God let the pigs in? Why, this he meant the Christians when they first took Jerusalem. So Fred's turning out to be a bit of an atheist, we think. Now, Islam, like any religion, can be interpreted any way you like, but it does tell Muslims to be kind to the members of the Abrahamic faith, so that includes Christians and Jews. But nobody of the Abrahamic faith like atheists. Fred will have some kind of silly hat ceremony. It's a bit of a dub because the patriarch isn't around to do it, and it seems he just used his German silly hat and not the official Jerusalem silly hat. I don't think Fred really cares. But we do have a situation where for ordinary Muslims, Al-Kamil's bullshit isn't flying. And while it would be nice if they were grateful for a new leader of Team Christian who is a friend to the Muslims, they don't like an atheist. The mob ain't happy. Muslim churchy guys will be having a big old whinge at the mosque, particularly in Damascus, which is General HQ for Al-Kamil's nephew Al-Nasir, who just found out that most of Jerusalem is no longer under his control. It's going to be war, but before we get to that civil war, should say that's it for the Sixth Crusade, and it looks pretty much like a winner. Fred has taken Jerusalem plus Nazareth, Sidon, Jaffa and Bethlehem without the need for a war. He should be top of the pops. Of course, Muslims don't like him because he's an atheist, but he should be top of the pops with the Christians. Well, no. For local Christians, he's excommunicated and he's a busy man, so he's off home to sausage land and left us without a king to protect us. He's an absent king of Jerusalem, so local Christians don't like him. I don't care that he's just organised a nice long peace treaty. But he should be top of the pops with European Christians. No, he's excommunicated, and he's just shown us what can be done without papal approval for a crusade, and he's won a non-violent war. Nobody likes a non-violent war. It's a stupid idea, and it will never catch on. While Fred had been in the Holy Lands, his deputy had been engaged in wars against papal territory. The Pope had got in our old mate John of Brienne. Fred will get back and tidy that stuff up, defeating the Pope's mob. Pope will now have to give him absolution. Back to the Middle East, the civil war won't last long at all. Al-Kamil will just cruise on in and take Damascus. Al-Nasir is out on the street. Al-Nasir will head over to the fortress of Karak, which was owned at one time by that Reynold the Cunt. He can sit there and be the beacon of hope for Muslims everywhere, calling himself defender of the faith and so on. But it's not just the Muslim engaging in civil war. The Christians want to have a bash at that stuff also. Fred might be gone, but he left a whole mob of his loyal guys there. Now, these guys are mainly Lombards from northern Italy. A couple of years after he left, Fred sent his main Lombard buddy, Riccardo, to be his chief pastor chef in the Middle East. So Riccardo is acting like he's the king of Jerusalem in Fred's place. John of Ibelin won't be pleased, because John had declared himself to be regent. Yeah. It can always be worse, so let's make it so. Templars will side with the Ibelin faction, while Hospitaliers and the Teutonic Knights will side with Team Fred. And now the local nobles will start to pick sides. This even spreads to Italy, where Italian city-states are picking sides in this stupid bloody civil war. If only we could play nicely together. But it's going to be Christian-on-Christian battles, and this stuff will go on for 15 years. Eventually that peace treaty will end between the Muslims and the Christians, 1239. And 100 days after the treaty has ended, Al-Nasir will strike and retake Jerusalem. All the Muslim poets will go nuts about how great he is. We may not think so. After taking it, he'll just knock down some fortifications and head on back to Karak, leaving Jerusalem pretty much undefended. Pink Floyd there on about the dogs of war, a subject that is always topical. Doesn't matter where you are in human history, the dogs of war are always off the leash. We got through the 5th and 6th Crusade there, and I don't want to go on to the 7th Crusade because it's a few years down the track and I'll be getting too far ahead of myself. So I thought perhaps we could catch up on our Templars. The last time they featured in a big way for us was that massacre, Battle of Haddon, where Saladin executed a whole heap of them. That's way back in Hank II's time for us, and not long after the Tom Beckett thingy. Hank paid for 200 brand new Templars as part of his penance for Tom's murder. No shortage of troops for the Templars. The Patriarch of Jerusalem, with two Templar masters, turned up at Hank's court to tell the sad story of that Templar massacre by Saladin, and to remind Hank about the need to provide those 200 knights. Much boo-hoo-hooing. The Patriarch can now go to the Templar Temple in London and consecrate the brand new Temple Church, dedicating it to the Virgin Mary. Our Templars in England had been acquiring land and constructing buildings of suitable magnificence for their noble and worthy selves. You may think this isn't in keeping with St. Bernie's original vision for a mob of warrior monks who value poverty, but we need to move with the times, and nobody likes a poorly stocked wine cellar. A bigwig Templar bean counter will request a survey of Templar assets in England. They have manor houses, farms, income-earning ventures all over England. Even the Templar chiefs are astonished about how much they have. Our Templars have built themselves a nice economic empire in England. The head Templar in Jerusalem will now start to have a look further afield to see if they can get a list of all assets. They have a ton of stuff in Outremer, of course, plus stuff in Sicily, Rome, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Germany, Greece, Hungary, France, Holland, the Netherlands, Scotland, and Ireland. A big thank you to Marshal Bill for the Irish stuff. These assets are quality stuff and include things like artworks, relics, all sorts of shit on top of the lands and buildings. Our Templars are wealthier than a king. Apart from being super rich, the Templars have all sorts of secular privileges. We all know that wicked King John loved taxes to bits. Only one mob came through that whole thing without paying a cracker. If you guessed it was the Templars, then take 10 points. And they are 100% immune from prosecution. No need to turn up to court if you can never be charged. They are above the law. Hank III will go further. No need to pay any fees like market fees. It's not only the secular guys, the Pope will declare them free of all ties, and nobody can excommunicate a Templar except the Pope himself. Plus, if a Templar turns up at a bishop's house, he has to get the royal treatment. Best tucker, best wine, best bed, and pick of the choir boys. And we have to put up a super special churchy service to say what a great guy this is. Let's hear from Sir Edward Coke. He won't turn up until the 16th century, but he's considered to be one of the great legal men of England. The Templars did so overspread throughout Christendom, and so exceedingly increased in possessions, revenues, and wealth, and especially in England, as you will wonder to read in approved histories, and withal obtained so great and large privileges, liberties, and immunities for themselves, their tenants, and farmers, etc., as so no other order had the like. So the Templars are top of the pops. And not only that, not only are they above the law, anybody who works for a Templar is also above the law. Can this go well? The Templars have got a great deal going for them in England. So much so, we find people who aren't Templars banging up crosses on their land to avoid taxes and tithes. They're pretending to be Templars. It will get so bad that the Poms will bring in a law with a penalty that if you're caught doing this, the Lord or the King will score your title deed and you'll be out on your arse. Plus, Templars can't be tried or charged by any court, so bad guys will find themselves a handy Templar to take to court with them. Templar just has to say, the felon is currently part of my household and it's case dismissed. The Poms will need to bring in another law to clarify that Templars can't do this stuff. The Templars have built themselves a big kingdom, which wasn't centralised in any one place, but this is a big organisation and it needs an organisational structure. The chief banana, or master of the temple, is considered to be the equal of a prince. You need to hand out an equivalent rank so that we know where this guy sits in any sort of councils or so on with royalty or nobles. The temple, of course, remains that temple in Jerusalem, so the Middle East is general headquarters. The master of the temple is elected by whichever Templars can get their arse over to the Holy Lands when an election is needed. His direct reports are the Grand Priors of Europe and England, who are based in France and England, and all knights hanging around the Holy Territory. He'll be the guy handing out appointments. Next level will be the Grand Preceptors. These guys seem to be the admin team looking after cash, properties and records. Confusing as it is, we then get more masters of the temples wherever in Europe the Templars have set up shop. These guys report to the Grand Priors and control the knights in their area. Our Templars will work out that this is confusing when letters fail to get through to the right guy, so the chief banana will be redesignated Grand Master while the various monkeys get their titles like Master of London and so on. And of course we get sub-priors and sub-preceptors and we're into a bureaucracy. The organisation is then split into chapters, which are spread all over. For our guys in England, they look after chapters in Scotland, Wales and Ireland, as well as England. Their tasks are business, buying and selling properties, managing incomes from properties, managing business ventures and personnel, replacing dead guys, sorting out applications from new guys. It's a corporation. Yeah, all right, cut that out. It's a holy corporation. Make you happy? It might be a holy corporation, but we're dealing with humans, so obviously there will be abuse. There are cases where some guy might sign on to be a Templar, agree that his assets will go to the organisation, then just forget to go to the Holy Lands and hang on to your loot while being totally tax and tithe exempt and not liable for any sort of prosecution. It's a big organisation, so people may not work out that you're rorting the system. But we do have a guy called the Visitor General, who acted like an auditor with powers to toss masters out of a job if he found bad stuff. The masters were also frequenters of the king's courts and undertook jobs for the king. They're big knobs. They also get to host churchy types as well as nobles from time to time. We're at the stage of our podcast where we get another chronicler, Matthew Paris. He can tell us about one papal legate who stayed quite a long time with the Templars in England. He made, whilst residing in London in the new temple, unheard of extortions of money and valuables. He imperiously intimated to the abbots and priors that they must send him rich presents, desirable palfreys, sumptuous services for the table and rich clothing, which being done, that same Martin sent back word that the things sent were insufficient, And he commanded the givers, therefore, to forward in better things on pain of suspension and excommunication. Yeah, that sounds nice and churchy, doesn't it? But these guys didn't always get their own way, and of course we had some that may not have been too bright. Let's get to Gerard de Ridford. Just after he became Grand Master in Jerusalem, he went to England to rip it up Hank II for failing to show up on crusade. At this time, Hank was getting old, so his barons rallied around him, told Gerard that Hank wouldn't be going, too busy in France. Then they took up a collection to give Gerard some cash to nick off again. Gerard would still rip it up Hank, saying he needs to do the crusade thing to atone for Tommy Becket. But he didn't say it nicely like I just said it. Hank will tell Gerard he would certainly enjoy killing the odd Saracen, but given that Gerard was worse than a Saracen, he wouldn't mind removing Gerard's head first. Gerard will storm off in a rage, go back to the Holy Land, lead his guys into that Battle of Hattin so that they can all be massacred. He will get a spot in the Kingdom of Heaven movie. He's the guy yelling out heresy and it's God's will and so on. He's also that guy that got Guy in charge of things along with his mate Reynald the Cunt. Guy's own brother will get the news that Guy is king and say, if they made that loose of the king, they'll probably make me God. Oddly enough, those Louisianes are going to come back into our main podcast shortly. They're going to be in England. That's bad news for us, isn't it? Gerard will be the third guy captured by Saladin along with Guy and Reynald at that Battle of Hattin. Like Guy, he'll be released by Saladin after the battle, but Saladin will catch him again later on and this time pop his head off. In between all that, he had a go at stealing that cash that Hank's men had stumped up. Another dickhead in history there. Now, this is no excuse, but they didn't always have a good role model. The patriarch Heraclius was operating at that time. He'd scored the gig because King Baldwin's mother thought that he was particularly good-looking. Gossip girls think that they were banging. He'd fall out with our chronicler, William of Tyre, who at that time was the Chancellor. We can't put the finger on Heraclius, but William will die of poison, and Heraclius is suspect. He'll also start to visit a hot chick in Jerusalem. Hot chick has a husband who will die shortly after Heraclius starts visiting. It was Heraclius's job to carry the true cross at the Battle of Hattin. We can't accuse him of being stupid. He decided he had to wash the dog that day, so he couldn't go and he just sent some lesser guy. Our Christian ordinary type started the day with a morale downer. After the battle, there weren't a whole lot of Templars left in Jerusalem, so the call went out. All hands on deck, and any Templars in Europe booked a water Uber pretty smartly. Soon as they get there, it's gee up the troops and attack Saladin's camp. It does seem that Team Christian would have been annihilated except for the Templars in this battle. They maintained strict discipline and kept the Muslims at bay, but it will be a big price. Around half their guys will die. Now they can go on to that siege of Acre, where Gerard will be captured and this time his head will come off. I think Saladin should have let him go to continue to be an idiot on his opposing team. Dick I Am The One turned up just in time to help out with a new Grand Master. Dick had got a Templar, Robert de Sable, to be Admiral of his fleet, and the Templars liked the guy. So it's straight into the top job for Robert, and a big thanks, mate, to Dick for bringing him over. As we know, Dick did the trick for the Acre thing, and the Templars got in there to take over some nice buildings for their new general headquarters. Templars are now based in Acre. There's some stories that when Dick tossed that Austrian flag into the cesspit, it was the Templars who jumped in to save a bit of blood being spilt between the English and the Germans. Then we had that march of Dick's where Saladin was covering him. Shall we have a description from one of Dick's mates who was with him? Let's shall. On all sides, as far as the eye could reach, from the seashore to the mountains, naught was seen but a forest of spears, above which waved banners and standards innumerable. The wild Bedouins, the children of the desert, mounted on their fleet Arab mares, coursed with the rapidity of the lightning over the vast plain and darkened the air with clouds of missiles. Furious and unrelenting, of horrible aspect, with skins blacker than soot, they stove by rapid movement and continuous assaults to penetrate the well-ordered array of the Christian warriors. They advanced to the attack with horrible screams and bellowings, which with deafening noise of the trumpets, horns, cymbals, and brazen kettle-drums produced a clamour that resounded through the plain and would have drowned even the thunder of heaven. Yeah, it doesn't sound like a lot of fun, does it? Now, this is that battle where the Hospitallers were the rear guard, couldn't take it anymore, and started the battle before Dick was ready. The Templars were at the opposite end, up the front. No particular mention of the Templars in this action, but you generally put your best guys at the front and your second best guys at the back. So, place of honour for the Templars. It would also be down to the Templars to go out on pretty dangerous foraging missions, and the records show they did quite well. Shame for our poor old farmers, but that's life for them. One thing we can tell from Templar correspondence is that new crusaders may not have given a lot of thought to food. If a call's been successful and we get a big mob turning up, then laws of supply and demand kick in, and the price of food goes through the roof. Templars are keen to point this out to popes with an appeal. Hey, tell these guys to bring their own supplies. It's causing a problem here. Getting back to England for a tick, the Templars would be important for Wicked King John. He'll use the London Temple as the lock-up for his money bin and spend a lot of time there. It will be the Templars who talk him into handing over England and Ireland as Papal States. Lots of his letters come from the London Temple, including letters to Gascony telling them to do over those heretics, the Cathars. John was hanging around in the London Temple when Magna Carta was going back and forth, and while he seems to have been rather tight-fisted, like other kings, John will give them land and toys to increase their wealth. If we move on to that taking of Diametta, there are two items where the Templars appear. First, that a ship described as large, transporting Templars, was sunk with no survivors. Second, that at one point the Muslims came out of the city to attack the besiegers. They were doing very well with lots of Christians running away, but the Templars rallied, formed ranks and won the day. We'd expect this. Highly armoured and well-disciplined and well-trained knights should win more times than they lose. This turned out to be the decisive battle that would win Diametta for the Christians. The Templars then nearly dodged a bullet. While they were winning at Diametta, Muslims were besieging their now general headquarters at Acre, so they left Egypt to go and sort that out. Unfortunately for them, they got back to Egypt in time for that deadly march to Cairo. Let's hear from the current Grand Master, Peter de Montagu. Hitherto, we have had favourable information and communicate unto you touching our exertions in the cause of Jesus Christ. Now, alas, such have been the reverses and disasters which our sins have brought upon us in the land of Egypt that we have nothing but ill news to announce. He then goes on to describe how the Muslims opened up those dikes and they found themselves surrounded by water and wading in mud. Some guys had been swept away in the flood and they seem to have lost all their baggage and food. A 15-year-old Hank III will not be off to a happy friendship with the Templars. He wrote to the Pope, having a big whinge that they're sticking up Templar Towers signs on properties they don't own to save that property from taxes and, of course, prosecution. Pope will appoint a couple of abbots to investigate, but somehow the Templars will work a deal with the king, so investigations won't proceed. After that, things will get better with the Templars helping out on diplomatic missions. Among these missions will be visits to foreign nobles to chat about marriage, but Hank will be a bit fussy and take his time to find the right girl for him. After those problems in Egypt, William de Montserrat, preceptor of Antioch, being desirous of extending the Christian territories to the honour and glory of Jesus Christ, besieged a fortress of the infidels in the neighbourhood of Antioch. He refused to retreat before a superior force and was surrounded and overwhelmed. 100 knights of the temple and 300 crossbowmen were slain, together with many secular warriors and a large number of foot soldiers. The Balcanifer, I think I got that right, or standard-bearer, how about standard-bearer, on this occasion was an English Knights Templar named Reginald d'Argenton, who performed prodigies of valour. He was disabled and covered with wounds, yet he unflinchingly bore the beauxant, or war banner, aloft with his bleeding arms into the thickest of the fight, until he at last fell dead upon a heap of his slaughtered comrades. The preceptor of Antioch, before he was slain, sent 16 infidels to hell. Yeah, that's where they go, infidels. Well, they do for now, but eventually some Christians will end up with that question saying, hey, what about, say, if you're born in, I don't know, India, and there's no Christianity there, does that automatically mean you go to hell? Some other guys will come up with this thing saying, well, no, no, you can still get into heaven if you've never had the opportunity to go to the church. And what you'll find is these guys have got it inscribed directly on their heart. Not sure what the message was, bound for heaven or some bloody thing like that. We'll have to wait for a Protestant Reformation for this sort of shit to start flying. But it's all magic stuff. You make it up, whatever you like. Make up anything you want. Back to the Templars. Our guys seem to think that they're invincible because God's on their side. So how do they explain defeats like this? Obviously, it's because they have sinned. The call has to go out again. Empty your country of Templars and get them over to the Holy Land. A bunch of English Templars will do that grand march through the country to get to their water Ubers, but not all go. Still, we do have infidels in England, Jews, so why not get stuck into them? A couple of Templars who were close to Hank III will find themselves in trouble. Their idea of ridding England of infidel Jews was to toss these guys in the slammer and demand huge amounts of cash to get them out again. Yeah, not really ridding the place of Jews, is it? It's just taking their money. But I don't want to get too far in front of myself. The Seventh Crusade is about 19 years away, so we'll leave it there. Templars updated. From humble beginnings, this order has grown to be richer than a kingdom and very, very powerful. We'll be back next week with Henry III. How will he go? Wicked King John set the bar pretty fucking low, didn't he? So, can Henry get over that very low bar? Yeah, not convinced. And now, my dear listener, a change of pace. I've been upfront with you right from the start saying, look, this is my podcast. I put on what I feel like. So I feel like a bit of more modern US history just to finish up. If you're not interested in more modern US history, then hope to see you next week for a catch up on how Hank's getting on. But if you're interested, here we go. A number of years ago, the US voted in this guy, George W. Bush, who perhaps wasn't the sharpest knife in the rack. He got in a few other guys to help him figure out stuff. Pick some hard men. Cheney, Wolfowitz, and the very scary Donald Rumsfeld. These guys did some really stupid stuff, and we ended up with a war in the Middle East once again. Like our crusades, this conflict is just going on and on. Among the stupid stuff they were doing was some really dodgy stuff, and perhaps just a tad illegal. Bottom line is that George W. ended up with an approval rating even lower, yes, that's right, even lower than King Donald I. King Donald bounces around 40%, but George W. ended up with 22%. And when election time came, it was OUT out for Republicans. So we got this nice guy, Barack Obama. Barack was a Democrat and the president, with the Democrats controlling both the House and the Senate. Great time for a total change in policy, and people were saying, hey Barack, how about you investigate those bad things that look pretty dodgy and clean up these bad eggs under the George W. Bush regime. That nice guy Barack said, you know, we need to put that dodgy stuff behind us and create a nice new USA. In fact, his policy changes domestically were pretty darn good, but as for international policy, he just continued with the USA policy since World War II, aggression. But nice aggression rather than nasty aggression. People in the Middle East didn't really notice much of a change. So people who did perhaps dodgy stuff just continued on waiting for the next change in government. Nice Barack had the House and Senate for 2 years, but he didn't do anything big and bold. Barack thought it would be nice to be a consensus leader where he could unite Democrats and Republicans with his wise ideas and we'd all be happy United States types. But Republicans have zero interest in playing nicely, as Barack would find out. 2 years into his administration and Democrat voters thought everything was peachy and failed to turn out to vote Democrat in the House and Senate. Republicans took control and Barack was pretty stuffed. No point in even thinking about looking at previous dodgy stuff under the Republicans. Among the dodgy people was, for example, George W.'s chief promoter of enhanced interrogation, or torture as it was more commonly known back in our times. This is Gina Haspel, and this dear sweetie is now head of the CIA. Another dodgy person was this guy, Brett Kavanaugh, He was an associate counsel to George W. It certainly is the case that Brett was involved in some capacity. Perhaps he was being good, perhaps not, we don't know. But he was involved in things like surveillance of the domestic population, the Patriot Act, which allows indefinite detention of immigrants, and you thought that stuff had been sorted out with Magna Carta, didn't you? And the ability to search homes without a warrant, so on. George W. rewarded Brett by giving him a judge-type job in Washington. The Democrats at one stage found their emails hacked. Nothing to do with WikiLeaks or the Russians. This was way back in 2002. The guy in the frame for this was Emmanuel Miranda, counsel to the Republicans. The matter, of course, was never investigated. George W. didn't want that to happen. Brett was implicated as being part of this. Brett was also involved in the naughty stuff done by Bill Clinton. Unlike Democrats wanting to put the past behind them, Republicans sniffing Democrat blood in the water will go a bit burko. Bill hadn't been a good Christian and was caught out in the hanky-panky department. I'm not going to tell you the sort of stuff Brett was proposing to ask Bill because it's all a bit icky, even for me. For this show, we don't care about that. Monica Lewinsky has always and continuously said that she was consenting in this thing. Bill, of course, threw Monica straight under a bus, but that is the way with human relationships. There's always a risk that you will be hurt. And, of course, in this case, Monica went from nobody knows who the fuck she is to the entire planet knowing who she is and what had happened. Bill, in the meantime, was making statements like, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, because that's the definition in law. You and I might feel like we've had sexual relations if we score a blowjob, but legally in America, no sex there, mate. One small bit of good news for Monica Lewinsky in all this is that those questions drafted by Brett Kavanaugh were never asked. I'm not sure why the Republicans went after Bill so hard. He was a Democrat president, but his economic policies was just really the Republican policy. While Democrat voters were happy campers with the president, Republicans were getting in wherever they could. And one of their big goals is a Republican takeover of the judiciary. It's still separate to the government, but great if all your guys are running it. They also got in anything they could, from a humble PTA to a governorship. Bottom line is that these conservative types always outmatch their opponents in zeal, enthusiasm, and organisation. 13th of February 1216, and Supreme Court Judge Antonin Scalia dropped down dead. The US Supreme Court is, like lots of US stuff, pretty weird. They appoint these guys for life, and on that basis, young people will never cop a break. It will always be boring old people. Great news for Barack, though. Antonin was a conservative, so it's Barack's pick for a new one. He can put in a liberal, except he can't because he doesn't have the Senate. So Barack will go for a compromise. He'll pick a guy that is conservative, but reasonable conservative, who may use his vote wisely. No way, get fuck off, say Republicans. You can't have a pick because there'll be an election in 11 months' time, and we need to wait for that. So the Senate just stalled until we got King Donald I. King Donald I picked a nice conservative judge who Republicans considered wouldn't tax his mind too much and just toe the conservative line. Then, believe it or not, another judge resigned, this time with an election due in 4 months. While Republicans had stalled the previous appointment for a year due to the upcoming election, this time they were in power, so it's we need to do it now. Enter Brett Kavanaugh, and we're off to a great process designed by Republicans. These guys know they're going to get what they want, so they start with a serious fuck you to Democrat senators. They send out their invitation to the confirmation hearing. You're invited. Party starts in just a few hours' time. Here's 10,000 pages of useless information on Brett. P.S. Don't ask for the documents on Brett that you really want, because we ain't going to give them. Then we got a sideshow. Ye old sex allegations come in, and Dr. Christine Ford. She's intelligent, articulate, and very credible. But it's old news, and it's just an allegation. There's been no investigation, no charges. It's a sideshow. So we get a form of an investigation, but not a serious look at the thing. Other women come out with allegations, but again, it's old stuff. Time for the clowns to enter the circus. Two guys turn up and confess it was they and not Brett who assaulted Christine all those years ago. The problem, as highlighted with the Me Too movement, is that women have failed to report sexual crimes in the past because it has been, and it remains, very difficult for women to get a fair hearing in the US and, let's be fair, around the world. But while women have got the numbers to get control and make real and significant change, like our Christians and Muslims in the Middle East, they're divided. And not all women support things like the Me Too movement. Those who do should seriously get out and vote. The more relevant performance in this circus was Brett responding to the allegations. His performance was abysmal, and if this were an honest and impartial job interview, Brett would have been out on his ass. But these are boring old white politicians who aren't interested in fairness and impartiality. It's like our medieval times. Do you believe the king's man or this woman? Subsequently, it has unfortunately come out that some of what Christine said was untrue. No matter, it's the sideshow. But it also came out some of what Brett said was false, and that matters. But by now, Republicans don't give a shit about anything other than getting Brett in. Among the performers at the circus, we had good old boy Lindsey Graham getting hot and sweaty. This guy's always played on his sweetness, and it's worked okay for him. He's not very popular right now. The big old spray didn't help him at all, and of course, what was he upset about? The process, the same process that was set up by Republicans. King Donald then decided to hit a new low, bagging Christine, who, whatever the case, deserves some empathy. But Donald wanted to give her a good kicking while sending a message to women generally, reinforcing that it's a bad idea for women to complain about sexual abuse in the US. At the same time, King Donald sent a message to young men in the US that it's a tough time for them because women might want to complain when they've been sexually assaulted.
I can't use public transportation after 7 p.m. I can't be brutally honest when you slide into my DMs. I can't go to the club just to dance with my friends. And I can't ever leave my drink unattended. But it sure is scary time for boys. Yeah, gentlemen, band together, make some noise. It's really tough when your reputation's on the line. And any woman you've assaulted could turn up anytime. Yeah, it sure is scary time for guys. Can't speak to any woman or look her in the eyes. It's so confusing, is it rape or is it just being nice? So inconvenient that you even have to think twice.
Yes, Lindsey Lab there, empathising with the plight of young boys in America. You can find her clip on YouTube, Lindsey Lab. All this, of course, has resulted in an increase of popularity for King Donald I. Well done, Donald. King Donald also claimed that Brett had been proven innocent. Again, there's been no prosecution, no trial, so no proof of anything one way or another. Helping Donald with his message were various Republican-leaning women on TV, happy to point out that sexually abusing young women is simply a normal part of life. Perhaps that's what they want to tell their children, but my mum and my older sister had a very different message for young me. Let's get to a conspiracy theory. A case, Gamble versus the USA, will soon be coming up before the Supreme Court, and the theory is that Republicans wanted Brett in there to vote the right way. This case involves what's commonly known as double jeopardy, and again, it's something pretty unique to the US in Western democracies. Double jeopardy says you can't be tried for the same thing twice. The twist is that in the US they have a separate legislation at federal and state levels, so you can be tried for the same charge at a federal and a state level. To the rest of the world, this seems pretty darn stupid and it would be logical to remove it. And that's just what conservatives want right now. We know this because 84-year-old Senator Orrin Hatch is supporting it. Really, USA? You've got 84-year-olds determining your future. Some of King Donald's top guys have been convicted federally, but he can pardon them. That pardon is no good if you're just going to be tried for the same thing at a state level where Donald's pardon doesn't work. And bear in mind, you've already been found guilty at the federal level, so you're going to be found guilty at a state level. Bottom line takeaway in all this is that under King Donald's brief reign, you have two new Conservative Supreme Court judges who are young and will be with us for the rest of their lives. Brett may still be there in 40 years' time. Good luck with it all, USA. Thanks to Eric Clapton for getting us into some historical fiction. This week I had a look at a book by Robert Broomall called Death's Head. It's a hero novel, so our hero is a young monk who gets himself into a bit of trouble in England and nicks off to the Crusades. He goes to the Third Crusade. Dick Iron the One is a bit of a minor character in it. It's about our main guy and that siege of Acre. And Robert gives us a pretty good description, I reckon, of what it might have been like to be involved in that siege, which, of course, very nasty. The young hero's got a secret. We don't get to find out what it is in this book. Obviously, we've got to keep reading if we want to know his secret. He doesn't know the secret either. And the love interest has been captured by the Saracen, so I guess she'll get saved in the next book too, which I will read. I quite enjoyed this. It was a bit of a ripping yarn. One little detail I did enjoy is he's got a character in there, a bit of a Robin Hood type, but this guy's known as Brock the Badger. Now, Brock is the old English term for badger, so it's Badger the Badger. I thought it was fun. Robert Broomall, Death's Head. Thanks for the read, mate. So it's a matter of what we go out with, and this week I've been listening to Imelda May. To be fair, I've listened to Imelda May for a number of years. She's a rockabilly artist, but her latest album, she's gone for a total change of pace, and I noticed a change of hairstyle. So let's go out with a bit of Imelda May, Call Me. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Then I pick it back up, praying for your name to pop up. Tell them, be that you're still in love with me. No matter how hard I hope, no matter how much I want, no matter how bad I'm broke, you still don't call. You've taken all the time you need. If I love means anything, baby, please call me. Can't sleep, I'm scared to dream.